We are again.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's 3 p.m., well, a little after 3, and it's April 25th, Monday, 2011, and welcome to Rules. And our first hearing, to actually work session and public hearing, is going to be SCR 5A. And Mr. Stenbridge.
Mr. Chairman, SCR 5A declares the last week of April of each year as Oregon Dance Week. Let's just see.
Senator Bonamici, I think. You can kind of wait here to see if you signed up or not here. And obviously, appears that you didn't. I mean, this is Rules Committee.
Therefore, she must dance. We make an exception if you dance, right?
Nothing else. We should follow the rules.
Apparently violated the rules.
Dr. Stenbridge gets back here, we'll determine the outcome of this.
Okay. I'll wait for a signal.
Well, we have two other folks, too, that are out there who have signed up, then maybe we might bring them up alongside of you.
That would be great.
So then that way you'll feel like you have some backup. So if Diane, would you show up? Thanks. And Tiffany? George? Thanks.
Would you like me to begin?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and committee members, I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, which is in Washington and Multnomah counties. Thank you so much for hearing Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 today, which declares the last week in April to be Oregon Dance Week. I sponsored this Senate Concurrent Resolution because I believe that even in difficult times, it's important to recognize the benefits of arts and culture. The art form of dance has many styles, from ballet to break dancing, and it's been a part of ceremony and celebration since earliest human civilizations. There's an ancient Hopi saying that says, to watch us dance is to hear our hearts speak. Dance involves flexibility, physics, and footwork. It can be participatory or performed and enjoyed by an audience. It's an art and an exercise. I was doing some research about dance and the history of dance in preparation for this hearing, and I discovered that the Mayo Clinic has reported that social dancing helps to reduce stress, increase energy, improve strength, increase muscle tone and coordination. And also the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute says that dancing can lower your risk of coronary heart disease, decrease blood pressure, help you manage your weight, strengthen the bones of your legs and hips. The New England Journal of Medicine found that dancing can reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. Co-chairs and committee members, I'm not suggesting that this Senate concurrent resolution is an alternative to health care reform, but with this resolution, we can raise awareness in Oregon of the benefits of dance by making the last week of April Oregon Dance Week. I want to let you know that when this resolution was heard in the Senate, we had, at the opening ceremony, we had some students from the Arts and Communication Magnet Academy in the Beaverton School District. They have a pre-professional dance troupe called Dance West, and we had students come and do a version of the tango on the Senate floor. So I'm just trying to build anticipation for you in hopes that this bill will move forward in the House. As musician and author Vicki Baum said, there are shortcuts to happiness, and dancing is one of them. I encourage you to support Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 by sending it to the House floor with a do adopt recommendation. Thank you, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
To Diane.
Hello, co-chairs and committee members. Thank you for hearing us today. I'm Diane Circle, Executive Director of Oregon Ballet Theater, Oregon's largest dance organization. And we support this not just because we're a dance organization and we're all ballet all the time, but because we serve a wide constituency across the state. In 1857, Oregonians celebrated our fledgling statehood with an inaugural ball hosted at the Willamette Woolen Mills right here in Salem. 2,000 years before that, Native American tribes were meeting on the banks of the Columbia River Gorge to trade, share news, and most importantly, to dance. We dance at weddings, at basketball games, bat mitzvahs, on the streets, on V-Day, in crowded high school gyms in Prineville, salsa clubs in East Multnomah County, and ballet schools large and small all over this great state. The dancers of Oregon Ballet Theater impact over 100,000 Oregonians a year through our performances, touring, and outreach programs. But it would be a mistake to think that dance is something reserved only for people who can afford the tickets and take class. And why is that? As Barbara Ehrenreich describes, dance is an expression of collective joy. It is through dance that we share emotions and experiences too intense to be expressed in other ways, like a father's first dance with a new bride, a ballerina's star turn in Swan Lake, the backstreet rhythm of any given Saturday night barbecue, the dancing in the streets after the victory on the football field or a Timbers game. We consider Dance Week in Oregon to be a vital and important thing for the whole state, from the 6-member dance squad at Burns High School who are representing their school with their dance and drill team at a statewide level, to the kids who may just kick up their heels on a Saturday afternoon. So we encourage you to support this bill.
Tiffany?
Hi, I'm Tiffany Jorgensen. I am an adult ballet student at OBT. I've been taking classes since January. And I just wanted to share what dance has meant to me over the years. I started dancing in high school in Portland on a dance team. And it kept me in shape. It gave me self-esteem, and it taught me teamwork. In college, it kind of fell by the wayside, and I didn't have much time for it. As an adult, I have struggled with weight and depression, and last November, some friends asked if I wanted to take a dance class with them. I reluctantly agreed because I thought I was too big to take a dance class, and I would be laughed out of the class, but luckily, my body remembered how to dance, and it's one of the best experiences that I've had. So I have been taking about 3 classes a week. I've lost 40 pounds. It's helped immensely with my depression because dancing just makes me really happy, and I think there's a lot of people who feel the same way. And that's why I would love to see Oregon celebrate a Dance Week. I think it allows a lot of people to see it as an art form and also as an exercise. I just love to see a lot of people get help the way that it's helped me. So, thank you.
Any questions? So I'm just kind of curious. I know you want to move and get this thing moving really quick. But Diane?
Yes.
Any stretching? What can you describe to me the stretching? Because I'm kind of understanding what stretching is all about now.
What stretching is all about?
Yeah, because you need to stretch, don't you, for
absolutely
this part. So, it's yoga. Do you do any yoga along with this?
Well, when in an adult ballet class, uh-huh. And when I started at the ballet 11 months ago, I had 0 ballet experience, and now I'm nearly an expert with about 26 weeks of ballet instruction. The body, just like running, you have to stretch your legs so that you have the tonicity to bend and move and develop. So ballet dancers are in the studio for a class that's 2 hours long, and then they are dancing for an additional 6 hours. So the stretching is both, they're stretching themselves way out in order to have the flexibility, and then they have to cool down so their muscles will go back into kind of the normal shape, and they're building layer after layer. So there's yoga involved, Pilates, which is the strengthening of the core, is involved as well as kind of the hyperflexibility. I think ballet dancers take it to a further extreme because they're, from a very young age, the joints in the body are moving in ways that we as mere mortals are not inclined to do with our bodies.
Member.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I think it's a little unfair that this bill came through the Senate first, so they got to talk about Billy Elliot, and it's too late for us. So I'm sure Representative Freeman was pining to see Billy Elliot, but I personally was, and
I'll be okay.
Missed it.
Wow. Is this okay? Did you have something, Representative Freeman?
I'm good.
Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, if I could make just a couple more brief comments. I wanted to explain, too, that the reason that we are using the last week of April is to coincide with National Dance Week, which is this week as well. And so we wanted to have it at the same time because it really would raise awareness. And then also, listening to Tiffany's story, I wanted to share a story about one of the students at the Beaverton Arts and Communication Magnet Academy. Was a couple of years ago really struggling with his studies, and then he discovered their dance department, which is really renowned, became an excellent dancer and received a scholarship to an art school in California and is doing really well. And I think that especially with some students finding something that's their passion, and in this case it was somebody who was struggling and didn't know what he was going to do and turned out to be a really stellar dancer, is just another story about the benefits of dance as an art form. So thank you very much, co-chairs.
And Tiffany, before you leave, congratulations. Good job, too, with that. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else here that has not signed up that would like to talk on SCR 5? Okay. We're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move the approval of SCR 5A and recommend a do-adopt recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves the SCR 5A to the House floor with the do-adopt. Is there any discussion? Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Wingert?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. SCR 5A is adopted. Anyone interested in what?
Garrett, I think, was wanting to do it.
Freeman wanted it.
Tim begged me beforehand to nominate him for this.
Who is wanting to care?
I said Garrett first. Didn't
okay.
I said it first. Freeman wanted it.
Who cares? Garrett Freeman.
That's
okay.
Fine.
We'll do that.
All right.
Okay. SCR 5A is passed and closed. Okay. Open up a work session, or excuse me, a public hearing on House Bill 3604.
Mr. Chairman, Victoria Cox is going to do the staffing on this bill for the committee.
Right here.
Everybody know Victoria?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3604 requires the United States flag, daily flag salute, and daily opportunity for the recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance in public school classrooms. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2011. You should have -1 amendments in front of you that delete daily and insert weekly on line 15 of the original bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6, Medford. You have in front of you a bill that's actually more or less a solidification of our current law. The current law reads that you have given people the opportunity to say the pledge on a weekly basis. Well, it's been kind of construed a little bit. Example, you're going to hear of an example that happened down in Southern Oregon where a principal interprets that as when you walk through the gate, you can do the pledge, and there's no other opportunity to do so in the classes. I don't think that's proper. I don't think that was the intent of the law. The other thing that we've added into this bill is public charter schools, and those are public dollars. Some of them have the ability to have a curriculum under the jurisdiction of the district, and some have different setups. This one works specifically for public charter schools and public charter schools only that, in fact, do comply with what the district would so desire, which is, of course, adhering to the law. Right now, I had a public charter school in Southern Oregon that refused to fly the American flag. They wanted to put up a world flag. I think that's inappropriate. And I think that we need to address that. Pretty simple bill. We've gone back to the old law, and they will be led on a weekly basis with the Pledge of Allegiance. So I'll turn it over to Representative Hicks.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Wally Hicks, House District 3, Josephine County. I come here in support of the proponents of this bill and also as a chief co-sponsor. This is, in my mind, a clarification, by and large, of existing legislative intent, particularly in regards to the charter schools provision. The flag is, and long has been, an appropriate symbol to display in our public schools. It's part of the education process. It's part of the understanding of what it is to be a citizen. And so I do very much appreciate the committee giving us this opportunity to hear the bill and urge your support.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, my name is members of the committee. My name is Chandler Court, and I attend Rogue River High School in Rogue River, Oregon. And for the past 9 months, I have been in a battle with my principal over whether or not we should have the opportunity to recite the Pledge of Allegiance in our school. I addressed this in September with a simple request. May we, the students, have the opportunity to recite the Pledge of Allegiance at least once a week to cooperate with the ORS. And his immediate response was, well, granted, this was before we had research into the ORS, but his immediate response was, it is against the law for schools to use the word God during school hours and on school premises. And it was particularly interesting because the school board meetings, though not all the time held on school hours or on premises, always begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. So after thinking about it for a while, I went home and did some research and discovered ORS 339.875, which states that schools must provide students with the opportunity to salute the United States flag at least once each of the school year. Having discovered this, I handed my principal a copy of the ORS, and as soon the moment he reached the part about the requirement for the Pledge of Allegiance, he was awestruck, and you could see the color rush from his face. He sent me on my way and told me to check back in a couple days, so I went back to class, came back a couple days later, and he had given me a compromise. His compromise was that he had set up a designated time and a designated place for the students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. This place was in a teacher's classroom, and one classroom in the entire school, and the time was at our break, which is used for using the restroom, getting books for next class. So after a couple weeks of this, which I didn't attend out of a protest, I told my principal that the compromise he had offered was unacceptable, and I again requested to have it right over the announcements just before third period once a week. He declined my request and just sort of sent me on my way. And so I got a petition with 100 signatures and presented that to him. And so that sort of made him rethink it. And now Rogue River High School says the Pledge of Allegiance every Monday morning at the morning announcements, school-wide. His idea of the interpretation of the opportunity, as Representative Esquivel mentioned, was that just by flying a flag on school grounds and offering us with some sort of a passing period, that was opportunity enough for us to say the Pledge of Allegiance, which was just unacceptable. While I was working on this, I contacted Representative Wally Hicks about this issue, and he in turn referred me to Representative Esquivel. I discovered that we were on a parallel path of sorts with the pledge issue. We had correspondence back and forth and worked down a bill that we thought was proper, and it's before you as HB 3604. Why did I do this, some might ask, is because we're all Americans. We were all born in America. We all have our First Amendment right. And I think that includes all forms of speech, be it the Pledge of Allegiance or whatever. I'm hopeful that the state of Oregon could set an excellent example for some of the other 49 states out there and maybe add this to part of the school's curriculum. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things, I believe it was Representative Esquivel, but it may have been Representative Hicks said, was that these are public schools paid for with public dollars. And, of course, when I hear that, I think about the reality that local property tax dollars used to pay for the most of the schools, and now in most districts, at least, it's less than a majority of the dollars come from the local schools. The rest comes, of course, from the state income tax through the budget that this legislature writes. What do you think about the idea of requiring that not only the United States flag be flown, but also the flag of the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I want to tell you the story about this public charter school. There's a flagpole there that was empty. So my wife, whom you all know, volunteered to get a flag for it and called Congressman Walden, and he provided a flag. And I, in turn, provided a flag for the state of Oregon, which was refused. So I believe that I concur with what you're saying. We did not put that in the bill, but I think one would go with the other, and I would hope we wouldn't have. Well, of course, I don't understand why we're here today, but we are.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I also concur and with the logic attached to it.
Thank you. That answers my question. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Committee, thank you. Or folks, thank you.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Let's
see. Jim Welch, you want to come up then?
I might just note, Mr. Chair, Chandler just got a thumbs up from his little sister. When you get a thumbs up from your little sister after doing something, that is a... Chandler, I was just noting that you got a thumbs up from your little sister when you got back to the audience. Is that your little sister sitting by you? Is that your little sister? That's a rare thing that never happens, at least in my household, so good job.
So learning experience.
That's right.
Okay. Okay, Jim.
Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, and committee members. Jim Welch, representing Oregon State Grange. And the National Grange, which has been established for nearly 150 years now, you would expect to have policy on this issue, and they do. And it's in favor of that. And I checked with the Oregon State Grange, and they definitely favor supporting House Bill 3604. And with that, I'll let you go.
Any questions? Hey, Jim, thank you. We're going to, let's see, Andrea Myers, you're on. Liar, excuse me. Won't happen again.
Happen again. Don't call her up.
Won't happen again.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Today, to at least raise some concerns, now that I've seen the amendment to House Bill 3604, it's interesting that I think actually the principal who said we can't do this had a legitimate concern. We have felt concerned that this law is vulnerable to a challenge because the pledge does invoke God and our Oregon Constitution being more protective, as I've spoken in the past, to many things, including religious freedom in this state. It has a particular provision. You will not find it in the First Amendment, no money shall be drawn from the Treasury for the benefit of any religious or theological institution. And that has meant, basically, that taxpayer money shall not be used in the public schools or elsewhere to fund religion. This law has not been challenged under Article 1, Section 5 yet. We're pleased that it will not go to daily, if that's the will of the committee, because that only exacerbates the problem. But we would certainly support an additional amendment, which is let's go back to the original pledge of allegiance. As you may or may not know, that for the most part during the time of this country, the pledge was actually different. And it was, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And of course, it was in the McCarthy era, during that scare, that in 1954, Congress chose to change the pledge of allegiance, with the prevailing assumption at the time that all good Americans, in other words, non-communist Americans, believed in a monotheistic God. And of course, we don't have that. We are such a broader and more inclusive society, and in our schools we are seeing that more and more. And I think it's important, and we've, even with the current law, with the opportunity to remain respectfully silent, we still get calls to the ACLU of Oregon with problems about students being forced to stand and otherwise engaging consistent with their religious or beliefs of their family. And we are becoming more aware, and we support this, becoming more aware in our state and our schools across the country of the issues of bullying. And I want to be clear, because I don't want anyone to jump to a conclusion of what I'm saying, but we are more aware that when children are feeling they are other, they are different than their peers, for all sorts of real or perceived factors, that is often the basis for which children are treated differently. I represented a client who, in first grade, for various issues, had to be identified as an atheist. It was not easy for him and his family, and this is in recent time. He had to change schools. So as important as it is to honor the flag, and we would urge that the old pledge go back so that it allows everyone to participate, except for some who, for religious beliefs, may choose not to pledge a flag, we urge it because it's more inclusive and allows children to participate far more meaningfully. So if you're going to look at the law, you know, we'd urge you to amend it back to the old original. For those originalists in the room, let's go back to the originalist language. But also, I would prefer that you just revert back on lines 14, 15, and 16 to the current language rather than changing it. Again, we think there are still challenges that we face with kids being forced to participate in manners that they don't want to, and so we'd hope to just leave it as it is. The other parts of the bill, the ACLU has no opinion on. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions. I had written testimony. I'm happy to give it to you if you want the education on the case law and tinker in a great quote from 1943 when the U.S. Supreme Court on the Jehovah's Witnesses spoke about this. There are some wonderful quotes, and I'm happy to provide that. But otherwise, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Actually, would if you could provide that to Dr. Stembridge, that would be great.
Absolutely. I don't want to waste the paper, and I already fixed my typo and reprinted it, so I'm happy.
Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, Andrea, if are you aware of the United States at any time entertaining taking the words under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance?
You mean the co-chairs, Representative Holvey, am I aware of what Congress since 1954... No, I have a hard enough time keeping up with what you all are doing in terms of what's being introduced, but sadly I have not followed what's in. Lots of things get introduced in both the federal and the state levels. I'm not aware, but you wouldn't want to ask me if you wanted a knowledgeable answer about whether such has been proposed.
Anybody else? Okay. Well, Andrea Meyer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson's.
Hey, going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3604 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3636.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3636 requires applications for Fish and Wildlife Commission licenses, tags, and permits to have a separate section where applicants can make voluntary contributions to be used for predatory animal control to the extent allowed under federal and state law. It establishes the Wildlife Conservation Fund continuously appropriated to the state Fish and Wildlife Commission for holding contributions and distributing contributions to counties for predatory animal control programs.
Okay, Representatives Greg Smith, Senator Wisnant, and let's see, Jim Welch, you want to come back up again? Okay. Come
on. Just, it's an honor. I'll
let the president go in the middle there.
Okay.
Go in the middle.
Oh, my goodness.
Welcome. Thank you for allowing us to be here. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith, and I have the distinct pleasure of representing the good folks in Wallowa County and Union County and Morrow County and the best parts of Umatilla County. And so I appreciate you giving us an opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bill 3636. I'm just going to share very, very briefly with you what this bill does and then turn it over to my colleagues who will be able to put a little more meat on the bones, if you will. House Bill 3636 does require the State Fish and Wildlife Commission to allow for voluntary contributions for predatory animal control within the county. And what I'd share with you is it's voluntary. Those folks who are looking to purchase a hunting license would have the opportunity to check a box and to allow a portion of their funds to go into a wildlife conservation fund that could be administered at a local level to assist in wildlife control. The reason for this bill goes back to ways and means, and that is dollars are scarce, and trying to take care of predator programs in the state is expensive, and unfortunately the state of Oregon simply has limited resources, and we've needed to come up with a creative mechanism to fund wildlife services. So, Mr. Co-Chairs, this is a possible solution that we would ask for your consideration.
Thank you. Senator?
Thank you, Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, committee members. For the record, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett, represent District 28, which is Klamath, Crook, Lake, the eastern part of Deschutes County, and about half of Jackson County. Once again, I want to thank you for hearing Senate House Bill 3636. The total funding for predatory animal control has been sequentially reduced for the last 10 years. I don't know why you're receiving a handout right now. That handout will show, particularly on the second page, that during that time, state funding has been reduced by two-thirds. County funding has been increased by nearly 50%. Cash-strapped counties simply cannot continue to fund this issue. They're as broke as we are. House Bill 3636 is designed to provide an alternative, voluntary source of funding to help sustain these critically important programs. Last year, the state sold more than 400,000 game tags, nearly 380,000 controlled hunt applications, and more than 240,000 paid hunting licenses. That totals more than 1 million transactions a year, more than $2 million transactions per biennium. House Bill 3636 provides the opportunity for hunters to make a voluntary contribution when purchasing their licenses, tags, and controlled hunt applications. As your staff told you, the money would be put into Wildlife Conservation Fund to be distributed to the counties where those hunts actually occur, where the tag is going to be utilized, where the controlled hunt would be created. The sole purpose for this distribution to the counties will be to help the counties pay for predatory animal control. I think it's an opportunity for hunters to help themselves by helping to fund appropriate game management in Oregon. I would hope that you would move this bill for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson. For the record, my name is Bill Hoyt. I'm the president of the Oregon Cattlemen Association currently, and I rise to speak in favor of House Bill 3636. We have had significant issues, Senator Whitsitt just said, in terms of funding for wildlife services for the last decade, and many counties have elected to suspend their contribution. And as you may know, that wildlife services is funded as a triumvirate, from basically what amounts to a third coming from the federal government, a third coming from a combination of ODA and ODFW, and a third coming from the county in which the trapper resides, administered from offices in Portland through U.S. or through USDA. And it's been a very because of money issues why these guys are spread so thin that there just isn't time for them to really do what they're supposed to do in terms of getting to the places that need it for especially livestock protection. They have to deal with birds and urban issues, and because of the chase for dollars has been made their life chaotic. And I was talking to our local trapper the other day, and he said when the U.S. government was about to shut down because they hadn't made a budget deal, they were told to pick all their traps in the counties, and so they spent 2 days completely removing every trap from that they had set and every snare that they'd done, and they'd wasted a huge amount of time. Then when the budget passed, why they had to go back and redo the whole thing that they'd done before. And these guys are sent many, many different directions. So the opportunity for us to assist the counties in funding their portion of the cost of predator control from wildlife services standpoint is critical for us. So we would hope that you would. We appreciate the hearing, and we'd hope that you'd support this bill.
Any questions? Chair Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It may be more of a question for ODF&W, and that's fine if it is. But where it talks about where the contributions go back, it says, I guess this is really looking at line 27 and then going on from there. If a licensed tagger permit allows hunting in an area within more than one county, the department shall designate a proportionate share of any voluntary contribution to each county based on the percentage of the area that's in each county. Is that, maybe talk a little bit about how these tags are issued. Are they, I mean, typically in a really narrow geographic area, it seems like there would be a fair number that would cover more than one county. I'm just trying to make sure this is important.
I can speak to our area. We have our ranch has two actual hunting areas in it, and the border runs right through the middle of the ranch. So where there's, for instance, the Melrose issue is in two counties, Douglas and Lane, and then the other side is in only in one. So if the permit was issued to someone to hunt that particular area that had more than one county, the way I read this, then the monies from those count would go to equally to those counties or shared by the percentage of the area that was geographically in each county. That's my understanding. Well, Owl County and some of the counties in the east, there are so many, the areas are so large that they would be in one county, I would think. I don't think there's going to be a lot of them. There's some on the west side where we're going to have some counties that are split like this and where areas transect two counties. I think this would apply, and I think that's the reason for this language. Okay. And that would be my best guess.
Yeah, if you take a look at the, Mr. Co-Chair, if you take a look at the Heppner unit, it actually is in Morrow County, part of Umatilla County, Grant County, and even grabs a little bit of Wheeler County.
So, if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Smith, based on that, you think this is fairly easy, even in that case where you've got three or four counties, you think that's still pretty easily enforceable?
I do.
Thanks.
Further questions? Representative Holvey.
Thank you. I was just sort of looking at some of the background on this issue, and I don't know if you could comment about it, but I see that the predatory animals also includes beavers, fishers and martens, minks, muskrats, otters, and I'm having a hard time thinking of all of those as predatory animals that are a problem.
Chair, co-chairs, and Representative Holvey, that co-vice chair Holvey. There, I got it right. That is the current definition in statute, and certainly beavers are not predatory on other animals, but they certainly are predatory on trees. For instance, geese are not predatory on other animals, but they certainly are predatory on crops and airplanes. So there's a lot of different functions that the wildlife services actually address, not just bigger animals eating smaller animals, but also those animals' effects when they interface with the human population on various different levels.
Continue.
Thank you for that, and I recognize that as well. Can you tell me whether the programs, these predatory animal programs that are established by the counties and that with the consultation with ODF&W and Department of Agriculture, do they have specific criteria that describes what animals are considered predatory for that county? Because I would imagine that some of these animals, like fishers and martens, I believe one of those is an endangered species, for example, and I wouldn't think that they would be on a predatory list. But is that up to the county, or does ODF&W and Department of Agriculture make that rule?
I would say that ODF&W makes that rule or makes that decision. But the bottom lower line is that if there was a problem that was being caused by one of these animals, in terms of, I can think of several scenarios, but probably not with martens and some of the ones that are described here, but I can certainly with beavers and with nutria and different things like that that can happen to the state. For instance, I-5 transects a ranch that I lease, and there are several culverts that go underneath the I-5. And the beavers have been known to block those culverts, and the culverts then blocked. Water backs up and floods over I-5. So, the person that's called in this case would be Wildlife Services to deal with either live trapping or removing that animal, and then the state would send in somebody to clear the culvert. So, these issues are not so much. I think the predatory aspect of it, there can be that aspect, but it's necessarily a wildlife damage control issue just as much as it would be, and as Senator Whitsitt referred to, as geese are, they're asked to deal, Wildlife Services by in a county by county basis is asked to deal with any type of animal that is having a deleterious effect on, you know, it could be a raccoon in somebody's attic, and so they get a call, the county gets a call or the city gets a call that there's a raccoon in someone's attic causing a problem, and so they don't know what to do and don't have anybody on staff to deal with it. So that city calls the county and the county calls Wildlife Services, and Wildlife Services goes to the address and takes care of the coon in the attic. Over on the coast there was a bear in a lady's kitchen and tore up her kitchen, and they had no one to call but Wildlife Services to come deal with that bear. So it's an issue by issue damage situation, maybe not so much always a predator, but that they're called in a wide range of different effects where animals are causing, the interface between humans and animals are causing an issue.
Yeah, just very quickly, Mr. Co-Chair, if I can add to that. If you look at line 12, on the first page, it talks about that voluntary contribution to be used for predatory animal control, and then it spells it out there, to the extent allowable under federal and state law. You know, and I I think one of the things that's important to point out is that predator control doesn't necessarily mean the termination of an animal's life. It may be simply the movement of an animal from one location to another.
Thank you. And for the record, I don't want it to show that I was sticking up for beavers.
I feel a lot better about that.
No,
Representative Holby from you. Yes, Representative Barnard.
Thank you. Ducks aren't on that list, are they?
They could be, yes.
No. Okay. All right, thank you. Kurt, are you able to come up and kind of just clarify a little for us, sir? Anybody else from the department?
Thanks. Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I do have Ron Anglin here with me as well. He's our Wildlife Division Administrator. Just wanted to follow up on a couple of the questions that had been asked earlier, and then happy to answer any additional questions. With regard to the question that Representative Hunt asked in terms of how would we break out the counties if a wildlife management unit includes multiple counties, I think for a lot of the controlled hunts, as the previous testifiers reported, it's relatively straightforward. We have a very good handle on that. It will also apply though to statewide licenses, mm-hmm. as well as some of our tags, which are very broad. So for instance, bear, cougar tags, they're statewide tags. Western Oregon deer tags or general season, or it's the entire Western Oregon. So I think there will be a little bit of art to this science of determining how all those different all the funds associated with all those different tags and licenses would be then distributed out to the counties. And so I think there'll have to be a little bit of discretion used in terms of the department in figuring that out. The second question I wanted to follow up on with regard to Representative Holby asked the question about how do we determine county by county which animals are predatory. And typically these Wildlife Service employees, they're federal employees that work in the counties, they work under the state's general laws applying to wildlife control. And we don't have any distinction. We don't say in Wallowa County that species X is predatory while in Multnomah County it's not. It's really statewide our determination of predatory animal status, as well as what's described in this bill. Ron, do you want to add anything, follow up on either of those?
Yes, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. And the actual definition of predatory animal has been set by the legislature, and that's found in ORS 610.002. So, Representative Holby, I think you mentioned some of the critters that fell under that, and that was something that was specifically delineated quite some time ago by the legislature and what Wildlife Services operate under and what we and Department of Ag operate under.
Hello, Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. We support House Bill 3636. The association provides about $36,000 a year to Wildlife Services to work on the various contracts, and that's with our own money. And we're very supportive of this bill, and we'd be glad to work with the department to make it work. That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Hovey.
Yeah, another question kind of popped up as I'm looking at this, and so it looks like this is going to programs that against predatory animals that are destructive to agriculture. And I'm wondering about my garden, or what about the paint job on my wife's car when a bunch of turkeys go through the neighborhood? I think they're kind of destructive, actually, and don't really see any programs that address turkeys either. Help me out with the distinction of agriculture alone versus my wife's car.
Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, Representative Holby. So turkeys, you're correct, do not come under the definition of predatory animal. They're considered a game bird. We do, and I'll certainly have Ron elaborate, and he can elbow me if I'm getting anything incorrect and incorrect here. We do have a number of programs, you know, within the department where we work with folks to try and control populations. Certainly hunting is the number one tool that we like to use. But we also do some additional control. And in the last 6 months or a year or so, we've actually had some municipalities that have also got into the business of working with us on actual population control. That's not necessarily trap and transplant. That's lethal removal. So, Ron, did you have anything you want to add to that?
Co-chairs Olson and Hunt, Representative Holvey, we have at times, on turkeys in particular, depending on the area and whether we can get permission from all the landowners, gone in and trapped and transplanted the birds. But those are typically activities that we do ourselves, and it's not something that would happen under the county programs that deal primarily with depredation, whether it's poking holes in the side of the house by birds, bears in garbage cans, whatever. We have lots of agreements between the counties that are participating to deal with those kinds of damage situations, whether it's agriculture or the home garden area, something like that.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a couple of questions about how exactly this would work. So my son-in-law goes to get a license to take crab out of the Nestucca Bay. Would he then be able to check, yeah, I want to add some more money to this fund at that time?
Yeah. Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, Representative, or co-vice Chair Berger. So I think the intention of this bill was really focused on the hunting license sales and hunting tag sales. Although the language here, I would say, is broad enough that it does also apply to, technically, to fishing licenses, I think, and just a cursory interpretation. So that begs the question, and you're correct. We would, through our license sales program, we would essentially be asking folks, would they like to make a voluntary contribution, much like happens at many grocery stores for a variety of causes, if you will. How those funds that may or may not be generated from fishing license or shellfish license solicitations, how those funds may be spent is, I guess, a bit of an open question.
Mr. May I pursue this, because this is, you're getting to the heart of my question. So he says, yeah, I'll add $5 more, thinking he's going to get rid of sea lions who raid his, but of course they aren't, because they're, you know, going to continue to rate it, but that's what he's thinking when he pays the $5. And then that $5, your agent who sells bait at the local bait store, then would send that aggregated periodically every day at some point to ODF&W in Salem, and they would throw it in this fund at the Treasury, and then at some point, how does that money get back to wherever it goes? And is there a fiscal to managing this program?
So, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Vice Chair Berger, there's several questions and several answers in that. I think, and as I mentioned, it's maybe a bit of an open question whether or not you would apply these to fishing licenses or not. And likewise, and really just thinking out loud here, if it was applied to fishing licenses, it may be an open question as to whether those funds could be directed at some of the predation issues surrounding fish and fishing, be they sea lions or avian predation on smolts. So I think it's an open discussion probably a natural place to go with this bill if you all choose to do that. With regard to how do the mechanics work, yes, our license vendors are all private entities. We have contracts with them all. They and their system is entirely electronic. We do regular, and I can't recall the accounting period, but regular sweeps where we get the funds from them deposited into our accounts. There's associated with any individual license, there can be several different accounts where those funds go, so it's all accounted for electronically. This would be no different. I think in terms of your question about is there or would there perhaps be a fiscal associated with the bill, I think there's probably some level of fiscal at least in the very beginning, in that we have our license system is really built on a privatization model where our system, both the hardware and the software, is all not only run and delivered by individual license agents that are private vendors, but also on the back end, the mechanics of the system is all private vendor. And so when we make programming changes to our license system, we actually have to do that through basically a request for that activity. And I don't know what any programming associated with this would cost. I don't think it's large, but I don't want to say that there is or there. I don't want to necessarily say what the magnitude is until we actually discuss it with them.
One last question.
Go ahead.
So I'm reading the bill, and it says ODF&W shall keep track of these contributions, and each quarter you should pay to each county which the hunting took place under a license tag or so. Tillamook County, presumably, will then get the $5 back that my son-in-law paid to get rid of that sea lion wish you great good luck in getting rid of?
Co-chairs and Representative Berger, I think it's certainly very possible and not out of the realm for us to develop an algorithm that essentially distributes those funds based on our sales transactions. And the intent here is not for the location where the license was sold, in the case of hunting, it's really focused on hunting, not so much the location where the license was sold, but the location of where the license is good for. You know, so if you buy let me give you an example, Mr. Chair, if it's all right. If you buy a Eastern Oregon deer tag to hunt in the Pine Creek unit, that Pine Creek is almost, if not entirely, in Baker County. Any donations that were associated with your purchase of that tag would go to Baker County for this wildlife control work. If it included fishing licenses, as you mentioned, our shellfish licenses are statewide. Our fishing licenses are statewide. Salmon steel cards are statewide. So we would have to have another approach to distributing those funds if, in fact, they went to counties. Right now, counties don't do any sea lion predator control, with the exception of a little bit of hazing, I think, on the South Coast, and
that might be voluntary.
So you get my point, though. There, I think we would have to figure that piece out if it didn't.
And so, Mr. Chair, one last comment, and then we're back to my original question: is it seems to me that you would have to have some buddy in your department monitoring and keeping track of all this, the fiscal issue. Thank you.
Chair Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I'm reading it, although the description at the top says that it requires each application for issuance of license tag or permit by ODF&W, going down to line 9, it seems to more clearly narrow it to each application for the purchase and issuance of a license tag or permit to hunt wildlife.
Yeah.
I mean, that the way I'm reading that, that would seem to narrow it down. Is that the way you read it as well?
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, I would agree, actually, that section does narrow it down.
As much as I hate sea lions and want to do everything to get rid of them, I just want to clarify, this is narrowly focused.
Mr. Co-Chair, please allow
me. Are you done? Okay.
My son-in-law thinks he's hunting those crab. I just want that on the record. He's a hunter-gatherer.
Any other questions, committee? All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Anybody else would like to testify on House Bill 3636? All right.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify that this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means to take care of the funding issues.
Thank you. Okay, you're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3636. And committee members, just for heads up, we will be holding over the work session on House Bill 2257. We still haven't received the fiscal yet. And then also on House Bill 3635, that will be held over to next Monday, May 2nd. Okay. This committee is adjourned.
Thank you.